Welcome to the Data Chief. The Data Chief is a podcast for data and analytics leaders to share their personal stories and insights on technology, culture, and leadership. As we embark on a new year with an uncertain economic future at hand, data and analytics professionals have the opportunity to utilize these data trends for maximal business impact at their organizations. We're joined today by three data and analytics experts, Tom Davenport, Tony Baer, and Sonny Rivera. As each share a bit of their background, expertise, and predictions for 2023, a common theme of investing in foundational principles shines through. As Cindy predicted in 2022, the role of the analytics engineer replaced that of the data scientist as the world's new sexiest job. But what does that mean for our analytics boot camps? And what should we be teaching there? What about the role of AI is changing in the workplace? And how will the workforce of the future cohabitate with it? And what data storage solutions are superior? The debate about data mesh continues.
The Data Chief is presented by our friends at ThoughtSpot, the modern analytics cloud company. ThoughtSpot makes it easy for anyone to analyze your company's data with search and AI. Business people at companies like Verizon, Hulu, Schneider Electric, Frontify, Hari, and Workato use ThoughtSpot to quickly uncover new insights and turn them into action. And you can learn more at ThoughtSpot.com.
Tom, I have to say welcome back to the Data Chief.
A rare privilege to be on twice.
A rare privilege to have you on twice. So I think back to the first year when we had just launched this and you so graciously shared your insights there. And here we are 3 years later and happy to have grown it. And what I always appreciate, you know, you have helped shape our industry so much. You teach, you write. I don't know how you find time to write as much as you do. You work with end customers. You work with students and just a wealth of knowledge. So I guess I feel like I should ask first, how do you do all this? How do you keep up with all this?
I don't know. I mean, doesn't seem to be too much of an exertion. I sleep less and less, I guess, but when I wake up, I don't immediately jump on and start writing another book or whatever. I don't know. It's just fun stuff for the most part. Pretty interesting to me.
It is very fun stuff. And one of the recent research notes that I really liked was survey findings around the role of the CDO. This is still a somewhat new role. Now, the majority of companies have a CDO, but tell us a little bit about the survey and maybe one of the findings that most surprised you.
Sure. This was a big survey of, I don't know, 260 or so chief data officers and equivalents, and sponsored by AWS, and I did it along with the MIT Chief Data Officer Information Quality Symposium. They, you know, had all the names and everything to survey. And then I interviewed 25 people. And I guess the biggest surprise was sort of the juxtaposition of two things. One, at least in all of my interviews and in a lot of the survey responses, people said, well, the big thing for CDOs is to create visible value, typically using things like analytics and AI, because they're much easier to show visible returns than data management activities. But then the thing that didn't really go together all that well with that is when I asked them, what activities do you pursue? The number one activity or kind of job responsibility they thought was data governance, which I find, you know, really difficult to show value. And I'm sort of surprised that it ended up as that high a priority. But in general, the survey and the interviews were all about, you know, creating visible value. In part, I think, you know, as you suggested, the role hasn't been around for all that long, and it's still sort of abstract to a lot of people. A lot of the respondents, I think in the 60% range, said people don't understand it very well. So even the peers of the person don't understand it well.
Yeah, well, so I think this alignment to value shows a maturing of the role. It's something that should have been happening regardless. And it's, I wonder if it goes back to that their priority or responsibility has been data governance, because some of those CDOs grew up through IT. And so I would think they're more first generation CDOs safeguard the data, protect it. And then as they evolve, or if they come from the business, it's more about the business value. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The great majority of them said that they had business and or business slash technology backgrounds. And their primary objectives are business oriented, not technology oriented, they said. But you're right, governance is a kind of protective function. And some of the interviews, people said they were trying to figure out alternatives to data governance, if you will, ways to make it easy to do the right thing without constantly telling people what to do and what not to do. But I think governance is kind of a defensive response. And yet most of the people in this survey and other ones that I've done have said, yeah, we're shifting our focus to offense.
Yeah, which I think is a necessary evolution. Some have said to me, governance is actually code for no.
Exactly.
which I think is a little harsh, but there you go.
I don't even like the term.
Yeah.
I tell people use enablement or something rather than governance.
I think that's great advice. It's a better word. So one of the findings that I liked was that now 23% of CDOs report to the CEO. So that tells me about alignment, impact, maturing of the role. And that's an increase from other surveys that like maybe Gartner has done, other industry surveys over time. So it feels like we're heading in the right direction. One of the predictions that I wrote for this year is that some of these CDOs can make a real play at being CEO. What do you think? Are we too early or is it possible?
I would guess that would not happen in 2023, but you know, it's
okay.
I think it maybe, well, the interesting issue is there, you could say, well, in a tech company, maybe, but many tech companies don't have CDOs or digital native companies because, you know, they think that everybody should understand data and analytics, and it's a pervasive kind of activity. So I think it's going to take a while longer, maybe, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years for legacy companies to say our business is really all about data and how do we use it effectively. So let's make this guy or gal CEO. I hope I'm wrong, but that would be my guess.
Okay, so Tom, you freak me out when you use the word legacy companies, because they do not want to be legacy companies. I think we need a better word, traditional.
They don't, but they are anyway. You know, they have technical debt. They have infrastructures that were built a while ago, and they're all trying, I think, not all, but the ones that are going to succeed are trying hard to update things and move into the new world of technology and AI and data and so on. But geez, it's a hassle. I mean, in one of my books that's all in an AI book, maybe we'll talk about it. It's about legacy companies. And I only have one startup, and it's headed by this guy, Gary Loveman. I don't know if you ever came across him. He was CEO of Caesars, really heavily analytics and data oriented, and really transformed that company into focusing quite heavily on it. So he has a new startup. He moved to an insurance company after that to start up a new consumer health division. And he said, you know, this is just too hard. Just costs tens of millions of dollars just to add a member's mobile phone number and email to the, you know, database. And so I got to do this as a startup instead. It's one of these kind of behavioral economics, nudging people into better health kinds of startups is called Well. But it's just really much harder, I think, in an established company. And, you know, that in a way is what makes it interesting to me. If everybody's already a believer, then you can move a lot faster, but there aren't nearly as many organizational change issues.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of tech debt, organizational change issues. Even as one CDO said to me, we don't have a talent problem. We have a lack of an imagination. So I do think your latest book, Working with AI, The Real Stories of Human-Machine Collaboration, is packed with great case studies. Tell us a little bit about that, or maybe what is one of your favorite ones? Would it be Well, or would you choose something else?
So that book we basically wrote that book because everybody makes these pronouncements about what AI is going to do to work, and the prognostications generally are quite wrong, talking about massive job loss. I think World Economic Forum said by the end of this year, 2022, which we only have a few more days left in, 75 million jobs will be lost to AI, which is crazy. I mean, I never find any companies saying that they fired anybody because of AI. Some in manufacturing because of robots, but that's about it. And so my co-author, Steve Miller, and I looked at a bunch of case studies of people who were working with AI today and seeing where their jobs are at risk, how did it change, did it make it easier, did it make it harder, what exactly was the human doing, what was the machine doing, and how did they collaborate effectively with each other. And basically the message is quite positive. We didn't find any outright failures. Nobody said, sorry, my job's going away tomorrow. No point in writing about me today. By the time the book comes out, I won't have that job anymore. Nobody said that. They all said they thought there was a big role for humans in the, you know, next, in the midterm anyway. Who knows what happens if we reach the singularity and AI is smarter and better than us at everything.
Yeah, and this is where I'll have to check out that study, because I feel like 5 years ago, there was more fear-mongering about AI replacing jobs. And now it's more that it would actually be a net job creator, but maybe certain jobs. So chat is a good one we can talk about. But if you think about chat assistants or virtual assistants, that might shift where the jobs are, but either way, it's a net job creator. Have I missed something there?
No, I think maybe you're talking about customer service kinds of jobs. Yeah.
Yes.
I think we haven't really seen it yet, but we could. And obviously some of these generative AI systems are really good at conversing with people. But, you know, they also give wrong answers much of the time.
Yes.
So I think the vast majority of us would still prefer to talk to a human if we're calling a customer support number. But I keep thinking that'll change. I don't know. It's been, we've been playing around with different technologies and customer service for a long time, and they're still not terribly good for the most part.
Yeah. So give me one of your predictions for 2023 or maybe beyond about one of these topics.
Well, I think the prediction for 2023 is that increasing numbers of us will have colleagues, coworkers who are AI oriented. And I really think the only people who have anything to worry about from AI are the people who refuse to work with it. So I did an article a few years ago with a radiologist in the Boston area who's also a PhD in AI, as it turns out. And he came up with this line, which we used in the article, of the only radiologists who are going to lose their jobs to AI will be those who refuse to work with AI. It's not quite true yet, but it's, you know, coming true, moving in that direction for radiology. And I think it could be said about accountants and marketers and, you know, with all these generative AI tools, content creators still require a human in the loop to create a great prompt and to edit the stuff when it comes out to make sure it's okay. But certainly collaborative relationship with a machine in more and more cases.
Yeah, so I think it's the human in the loop, or the human plus the AI, that makes it the better combination. That's what speeds the diagnoses and removes some of the bias from the radiologists. But maybe if it's full AI, does that, or black box AI, does that worry you about the degree that we rely on this in terms of bias at scale?
Well, but the bias doesn't worry me as much because humans are hugely biased. I think even more so than AI is generally. Yeah. Of course, you know, if AI models are trained on what humans have made for decisions in the past, that will probably find some bias, or incorporate some bias. But what does worry me, I think, if the models are not transparent, that people will just refuse to use them. I mean, going back to radiology, there's an academic study, which I really like, of three groups of radiologists in a big hospital in New York. And two out of the three groups, they all three have to use AI to kind of confirm or deny their initial judgments. And two of the three groups just kind of blow it off if the AI disagrees with them because totally opaque, you know, the models they can't make any sense of. And so they just say, forget it, they must be wrong. I don't know why, but so we need to make progress, I think, on the transparency of these models so we could have some sort of, I don't know, dialogue, if you will, between what the machine thinks and what the human thinks. And that kind of collaboration is not easy to create. You know, it requires both sides compromising a bit.
Yeah, or I would say, well, transparency breeds trust. I think it's easy to create if you build that into the design from the beginning. It's hard to go back if you have black box AI and not reveal what were the inputs, what was the sample training data, things like this. So I think that's what makes it hard.
Yeah, but it's really hard. I mean, you know, the most powerful form of AI that we have now is deep learning, neural networks, and those are almost exclusively black box. Very, very difficult to make sense of them. I mean, take GPT-3 for creating content. 175 billion parameters. Oh, sure. Yeah, I, as a human being, am going to make sense of what those parameters, what those loadings are on all those parameters, and how did that come out with that particular bit of text or that image or whatever. Not going to happen.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. I was wondering if you were going to bring up GPT-3 because it is just blowing up and the fastest ever to get to 1 million downloads. And I remember a talk that we were doing, I think, for VentureBeat in the last 2 years, and I asked you, were you concerned now that it started out open source, but now Microsoft being the main backer and owning it? And what did we think? Was this a good thing or was this a bad thing? So what do you think? Or give us a prediction around who's going to leverage it best or how in 2023.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's sort of a mixed bag. On the one hand, I like the fact that it was open source, but one of the big investors was Elon Musk. And frankly, I'd rather have Microsoft in charge than Elon Musk in charge of anything. I just sold my Tesla because I really can't support that guy anymore. And two, I think there's a lot of competition now to GPT-3 and when GPT-4 comes along and so on. And so I'm not as worried about one company dominating this space. I do think that they sort of have the lead right now, and ChatGPT has been kind of wowing everybody in the past few weeks, but certainly there are competitors and some of them are open source, you know, Hugging Face and Midjourney and so on.
Yeah. Exciting times. All right, Tom, I feel like I have to tell you my Tesla story. I'm going to share that offline, but I just bought a Ford Mach-E for similar reasons, I think. But so let's wrap up with a fun prediction. Give me a sports prediction, or maybe how much snow is Boston going to get? What do you think is going to happen?
I think that it's going to be mostly warm in the Northeast, but I don't really care because I'll be in California. That's my prediction.
Wait, now everyone in the Northeast is not going to follow you anymore. They're going to be living vicariously through you.
What I really care about is that we get some rain in California. And we've had some over the past couple of weeks, but as you know, it's pretty dire circumstances out there.
Yes. Yeah. Any resolutions that you most want CDOs or CDAOs to follow in the year ahead?
Well, if you're CDO, do whatever you can to become a CDAO, because that makes the job a lot easier, I think. And obviously it has its challenges, but you can show value much more readily. And don't talk about governance, as we discussed.
Enablement.
Yeah, enablement. And try to start to, if you're on the analytics and AI side, start trying to improve the productivity of these activities with feature stores and reusable data sets and so on, because it's really not a terribly productive enterprise. And finally, adopt the data product management idea to sort of get things deployed and manage over time and not just creating models that sit on the shelf.
Oh, good. All right. You couldn't have teed up our next guest any better. Oh, Tom, always a pleasure. Thank you for being on the Data Chief.
Thanks, Cindy. My pleasure.
Now, let's jump over to Cindy's conversation with Tony Baer of DBL Insight for our next trend.
So, Tony Baer, welcome to the Data Chief.
Hey, Cindy, thanks for having me.
And where are you joining us from today, Tony?
I'm joining us from Maplewood, New Jersey.
And you know what cracks me up? I think all the years I've known you, I don't think I realized you live in Maplewood, which is not too far from me and was just a few towns over from where I grew up in Oakland and Franklin Lakes.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, I know exactly where you're talking.
Yeah.
But my biking territory.
Yes, your biking territory. It's who knew we have a pretty part of New Jersey. But Tony, you and I have known each other for decades, I think, but you just made a recent big career move. Tell us about your new role and why you made this move.
Well, that recent move is about now 3.5 going on 4 years ago, where I established my own after basically just a little over a decade at Ovum, where I established the big data practice. I then just had this crazy idea to go off on my own and be my own boss and be my own employee. And I must say the quality of the hired help sometimes leaves questions to, choices to be desired. But no, it's really been a really enjoyable run. And I get to work with a lot of the same people and a lot of the same companies. It's really about being part of this community, and it's just a lot of fun.
That's great. And I think now, have you also partnered with Andrew Brust, is that right? Or am I getting confused here?
We've been on and off, I would put it this way. I mean, we've been beer drinking buddies for years. And it's been more of an informal partnership. And yes, he is part of our data collective. So yeah, it's been very rewarding.
Okay, great. So, Tony, one of the reasons why I wanted you to join our predictions episode is because if I go back to fall of 2021, I said then that the data mesh, data fabrics, lakehouse will usurp the data warehouse and finally dethrone the data warehouse. And so you think about how we all do our predictions. Who could have imagined what a hot topic it was in 2022? And yet you, I think, wrote some of the best series of articles breaking down some of the differences. So did you envision it would be so hot throughout 2022, or did it surprise you?
It's kind of surprised me. And I'll give an example. And this is sort of what triggered, why you've graciously invited me onto your podcast today, which was a few weeks back, it was Sunday night, I was packing for Amazon reInvent. And I was doing some multitasking at the time, and I was doing a Google search, and I came across this really ridiculous article of something like the 8 best data mesh software companies.
Yeah.
And I just thought, this is just ridiculous. I mean, this is exactly what I was, you know, I wrote about this, you know, basically about a year earlier. It's like, you know, watch out, basically, you know, a lot of the tech industry is going to start to data mesh wash its products. And so I just wrote it was a throwaway, you know, I scribbled down about a paragraph in probably about, you know, just a couple of minutes, didn't think anything of it. And 15,000 hits later on LinkedIn, we're having this discussion. It just amazed me that that small little post, innocuous post, throwaway post, touched such a nerve.
It did touch a nerve. And for this year, I liken it, the prediction is really, well, we have to get past the religious wars, the holy wars. So I think that's why you got so many comments. But I do predict that organizations that embrace the data mesh concepts, so to your point, it's not a technology you can buy, but I believe that they will be able to outperform organizations that focus only on a data warehouse, and they'll deliver more value at a lower cost. Do you agree or disagree?
I have, be perfectly honest, I have some mixed feelings about data mesh.
Okay.
When I say mixed feelings, I don't mean ambivalent. It's like, I think probably a better metaphor, a more apt metaphor, is that one foot is in a bucket of boiling water and the other foot is in a bucket of ice, dry ice.
Okay. Oh my gosh. Both sound painful, but we don't like ambivalence. So lay it on us. What makes the boiling water and what makes the ice?
Well, okay. For the purpose of this discussion, I'll tame down the temperature of boiling water to basically to warm water, and come down the fact that basically the Jamak is basically, you know, came up with some very brilliant ideas about 3 or 4 years ago, which is that if you take a look at what was happening with data lakes, and we've been, and Cindy, you and I have been talking about this for a number of years, of data lakes basically, you know, degrading into data swamps. We just collect this data, cloud storage is cheap, of course, a lot of cheap gets expensive. Expensive not just from an economic cost, but also from basically the legal and reputational cost of collecting data that maybe you should not be collecting or using in such a way. And so I think there's been a big concern about all this data just getting lost in cloud storage and nobody's really thinking about it. And Jamak basically, you know, very correctly pinpointed the problem and said, you know, we really need to take a much closer look at what we have there and who are the folks that really are best, you know, suited for doing this. And it's really, you know, what she calls the domains, which, you know, we used to call subject matter experts or teams or business, you know, or business units, you know, whatever, people who are closer to the trenches, not from up top. And so I think that her ideas there, and in terms, you know, which is that those folks should be taking responsibility and ownership, and they should take a life cycle view and view these data as product. In other words, it's not just the data set, but it's also all the pipelines, it's the governance, the security. You need to take a very holistic view of that data. I think that was brilliant.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I have a lot of trepidation about that because I could also see that this could lead to more data silos. And I know that, and what she's talked about to basically bridge the gap is what she calls federated computational governance, which is a great idea, except that it's an idea that we've been wrestling with forever and will continue to wrestle with forever. And I feel, and my trepidation here is that one of the best practices and the technologies are really not quite there yet. I do think that in certain situations, in certain scenarios, data meshes will work. But, I went down on record on this, you know, about a year ago, I said that you really need to be careful. I think where they will work is where you have teams or domains that have some sort of shared context. And that context could be that they're involved in a similar area. For instance, let's say you're a consumer packaged goods, CPG company. And so therefore, your supply chain, your accounting, your logistics, manufacturing will all be related domains, and they all have some common understanding of the data. Whereas to try and generalize this out to an entire enterprise, well, maybe eventually, but I think that, you know, I think it will work basically where they have, you know, have shared context. Now, that shared context, it could come from, you know, the same subject area or from teams that are accustomed to working with each other and know each other. So I think in those circumstances, it can work. I'm very nervous about the idea of trying to do any type of big bang approach.
Oh, yeah. And she would not advocate a big bang.
Exactly.
One of the things you say is the federated computation. Now, I think this gets into it's nice in theory, but ultimately we also need performance. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you move the data for performance reasons or for cleansing reasons and things like this.
Right.
So I think it's still a work in progress, which she also acknowledges, and it's not right for every organization.
Right.
But I would ask you then, what is the better alternative, or what do you predict? Is it the data fabric? Do we stay in the data warehouse world? Are you advocating more the lake house? What's better?
I don't think it's an either or question, frankly, because data mesh is really about ownership of the data. And Jean-Marc would basically say that where it's physically housed is kind of incidental to all this. What I do think is really essential to all this is that basically any organization that is practicing data mesh needs to speak with basically from a common playbook or at least a common language. And so at the base of all that is metadata. I think we need to have a common language for expressing what this data is and for describing it and describing also practices on how we work with it and govern and secure it. Otherwise, I think we're in a situation of being in the UN General Assembly without interpreters. And so therefore, this is what I basically wrote a year ago, and I still fervently believe this, is that you can implement a data fabric, whatever that is. Admittedly, the definition of data fabric is still hazy, but let's say it's a common metadata backplane for argument's sake for the moment. You can implement a data fabric regardless of whether you're practicing data mesh or not. But what I was saying is don't even think about implementing data mesh unless you have some sort of fabric at least starting to go in place.
Yeah. And so this is then where the technology comes into play. So I want you to imagine, so stop being an analyst, an industry watcher. You just got hired as the CDO of your favorite company. And now you're going in. Is this also where are we seeing acceleration of data catalogs to enable this shared metadata? But what is the approach you're going to take? And let's make it even a little more fun. Let's assume it's a startup, so you don't have to worry so much about all this legacy tech.
Well, the good news is in a startup, you're going to have that shared context. You're not going to have this organizational sprawl. You'll have a shared mission. And so in a startup, I think actually it will be when you're starting off with a clean slate and with all the players, basically, hopefully on the same page. Otherwise, that startup will become a historical footnote in a year. I think it makes a lot of sense to say, let's organize into teams around our different data products and take that lifecycle view of the data product. And there I would say, obviously, a catalog. At that point, when the organization is small, you probably will not need to go all the way to the extent of having a data fabric. You could probably, through a catalog, enforce some of that metadata because basically everybody knows each other. It's when that organization grows and where people no longer are united by the fact that everybody knows each other personally, that you then have to start putting these mechanisms, these structures in place. And that's where something approximating a fabric would then need to come in to complement that catalog. Because the catalog itself is really the discovery. It's a discovery tool, and it's the tool where you can apply governance, but it's not the governance tool. In a small company, it's where it can perform more of those tasks. When you get to a larger organization and people do not have that same immediacy, then you need to start formalizing out the infrastructure and then start to basically formalize out the technology stack.
Okay, great advice, Tony. So Tony, give me a bold prediction and a resolution that you wish data leaders would do in 2023.
One is that I think they definitely should, adopt the data mesh practice of looking at data products and taking a lifecycle management approach to it. Do it with basically, we'll start with the lowest hanging fruit, which is the most business critical processes that are key to your most important goals in the new year. In other words, don't try and go big bang or implement this broadly. Basically identify high impact goals and really and focus on the fact of, one, a life cycle management approach, and to ensure that basically your teams or your domains are on the same page. That would be my immediate advice.
Great. Thank you, Tony. Now give us a fun one. Personal, sports, give us a fun prediction or resolution.
Oh, gosh. Next year, I'm hopefully going to crack my PR with biking and basically do about 2,500 miles. During the pandemic, it's been hard for me to break 1,000, but next year we're going to try and break out. And now that we can travel again, we're going to this travel euphoria, this leisure trips. I'm going to take that bike trip of Spain and that bike trip of Italy.
Oh, beautiful. Those sound like fantastic bike trips.
Oh, gosh,
and if you
yes.
want to train, come up in my backyard, the Appalachian Trail. I can highly recommend it.
Okay.
Great.
Sounds like a plan.
It does. Thank you for being on the Data Chief, Tony.
It's a pleasure, Cindy.
Finally, let's hear from Sunny Rivera, Senior Analytics Evangelist at ThoughtSpot, on our final trend of the episode.
Sunny, welcome to your first episode of The Data Chief.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Where are you joining us from?
I am joining you from really frigid Charlotte, North Carolina. How is it there? Because it is extremely cold here. It's like the coldest day of the year, I think.
Oh, don't even give me that. And we already had Tom Davenport talking about how he's going to be in sunny Southern California soon. So nothing will compare to the Northeast. But Sunny, it's great to have you on the Data Chief. And what I'm excited to introduce you to the Data Chief listeners is you will get to hear from Sunny multiple times throughout this season, as he also brings voices of some of the customers and personas that he works with, including analytics engineers, data architect. So Sunny, I want to first talk about a little bit your background in the data and analytics space. Tell us a little bit about where you started and where you are today.
Wow. So I'm going to go a little bit further back. I'm going to go way back. Okay. So to 1995, I actually started my own company for data modeling. And so we built this great little product, and we were doing quite well until this other competitor came along. You may have heard of them, a little company called Irwin.
Yes, and I know. All data modelers are thinking, oh, bring me back that time.
And Irwin, back in the day, was called ERwin. I don't know if you remember. People used to call it ERwin. Well, they actually kind of dominated the market, and we ultimately sold our intellectual property to them. So I like to think a little bit of that code that I started with is still there. So I started data modeling and building a company for that years and years ago. And then I kind of moved here to the Charlotte region and worked in the insurance industry, building data platforms for companies like The Hartford, and went on to build cloud-based data platforms and migrating people from on-premises to the cloud.
Yeah. And so I think this is one of the reasons why we brought you into ThoughtSpot as a senior analytics evangelist, is that you really know the challenges of on-premises, but also the promises of cloud, and have helped customers get there. So when did you first start working with cloud data platforms? And even you also have implemented and migrated apps from like Sisense to Looker, implemented ThoughtSpot. When did you first start working in cloud products?
You know, it was early in, I started working for a digital media company, and I thought I was building a desktop, or I thought I was building, you know, just like a software product when I joined the company. Then I realized we were building a cloud-based data warehouse for marketers. And that's when I got started. That was about 2010, and really, really early, because we were using, you know, Microsoft Azure very, very early, AWS very, very early. And we, you know, those kind of grew and grew out of, I'd say, the early cloud platforms, and then into things like Looker and Amazon Redshift and other products like Sisense as well.
Yeah, so that is quite early because Amazon Redshift really only came out in the market in 2013. So we can say that you are a pioneer in multiple things. I think the other thing, just having worked with you now for the last 6 months, I feel like I keep finding little nuggets out about you. I think it would be great for listeners to hear about how you used your technical skills during the Gulf War, if you're willing to share.
Oh, yeah, sure. So this is actually quite interesting. Early on, and I was straight out of college, and I got thrown into the defense industry out of college, and I started building a tracking system, actually digital imaging system for those first TV-guided missiles that you saw in the first Gulf War. So if you recall, we were all like glued to our television sets at around CNN watching these happen. Well, I was actually writing the software that processed the image and issued the steering commands on those weapons. And my future wife was the woman who developed the algorithms for all of the tracking. And I was just, as I do today, doing what she told me to do.
Oh, wow. And see, I didn't know that about your wife. So she's an algorithm person, too. It's great what we learn on these podcasts. Now, Sunny, you and I worked on the Data and Analytic Trends ebook. And one of the trends that we want to talk about in this episode relates to a prediction around analytics engineers. But I want to go back because the other thing that you are very active in is the DBT community. So tell me a little bit about how did DBT get on your radar in your previous role? And how did you make the case for bringing in a new technology into a very traditional organization?
Yeah, so in the financial services industry, right, they are very, very conservative about cloud, about having their data in the cloud. And so they moved very, very slowly. And tools like, you know, DBT and their cloud-based offering they were very hesitant about that tool. So before I go into that, what is DBT? DBT really is a data transformation tool. It enables data architects, analytics engineers to model their data, create their pipelines, test, and then deploy their product as if it were software like the rest of everyone else is doing in their agile software development. So I think that's the huge breakthrough of DBT. They've taken the data modeling, the data warehouse building, and turned that into a software development process that can be done agilely. So that's what DBT is. I think the way we were able to show value and sell that internally to the business was to look at the amount of man hours that we were spending, hand coding all of these pipelines, hand testing all of these pipelines, and saying, okay, can we do what we called data warehouse automation? We gave it an acronym like everybody else, DWA. And we were able to show we could decrease the time to market by about 40% and the amount of effort like 60%. So we greatly reduced the number of folks doing the work as well as the cost associated with it. And then we got to market quicker.
Those are some hard business benefits. And I think the other reason why DBT is taken off like wildfire is because it's open and leveraging SQL, a skill that is broadly available. So the reusability is there, but I think it's also the commonality of these skills. So let's go to the prediction that we shared that relates to the analytics engineer. Tell us this prediction.
Cindy, I think that in 2023, analytics engineers that have data modeling skills are going to command higher salaries than those without. These are really important skills to have, and there's a lot of demands being put on this analytics engineer's role. If you think about what's happening with analytics engineers, they're a hybrid role. We have engineers that need to build data models for the business, to do self-service analytics, maybe leverage semantic layers, Add into that Python skills. And I think you're going to see more and more importance on data modeling to enable that key feature that we hear everyone talking about, which is self-service analytics.
Okay, so let's unpack this a little bit, Sunny. And I have to go back to last year's predictions where I said that I believed that the analytics engineer would replace the data scientist as the world's new sexiest job. And I do think that played out in 2022. Do you agree, disagree?
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think that's what we saw. We saw a huge demand for those for that job. And it is a very popular job. You saw so many titles and so many people wanting that role. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think people realizing that was the work they were doing. So we see this acceleration in the role, but how in the world could these people not know data modeling? Where have we gone wrong? Is it no longer a relevant skill in cloud data platforms, or how did this happen?
You know, I have a theory. We've spent a lot of time on platforms, and there's been a lot of effort and innovation on data platforms, Snowflake, Databricks, GBQ, AWS Redshift, all of these platforms. And now I think what we're seeing is the platforms are mature and people are saying, okay, how do I get business value and insights from this? And that's why we're seeing so much push on these analytics engineers.
Yeah. So it's a skill maybe that they, if they started as a data engineer, maybe they never really got the data modeling part. Or if they've been self-taught. And I actually saw something on Twitter, one of the track sessions, making fun of like Ralph Kimball and some of the other concepts of data modeling, whether it's Data Vault or Bill Inman's modeling approach. So is this something that people who were self-taught, they just didn't learn it? Are we not teaching it enough in data science and analytics boot camps? Or what do you think is going on here?
You know, I do think that it is not taught enough. People are maybe focusing on some of the tech side of it as opposed to the actual art and science of data modeling. And I also think what you see in the market is we've pushed so fast, get something to market quickly, that maybe the emphasis on the quality of the models, the reusability of the models, the ability to enable something like self-service analytics was not as highly valued. And now that we see, okay, we don't want to rebuild over and over and over again, let's put a little more effort into our modeling.
Okay, so as you look ahead to 2023, what would be a resolution that you most want either the data architects or the analytics engineers to have?
You know, I would love to see data architects, analytics engineers model for a domain and not for a single problem. So I think that's a big part of what we see is let's do one big table that solves exactly one problem. And I'd love to see us model for a domain that solves a lot of problems.
Okay, Sunny, I'm surprised you didn't revert to acronyms here. OBT.
Yeah, one big table. I understand why people do that. It's really easy to do. It makes users of that data who are maybe Excel users that like to think of it as just an Excel sheet, it makes their job a little bit easier. But it does, one big table does cause what I call one big problem. You can't update your data. While it may perform well on one specific query, it's hard to maintain and manage, and it definitely doesn't scale to add more data to it.
Great advice, Sunny. Sunny, a pleasure having you on The Data Chief.
Thank you so much. Look forward to coming back.